You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on Radio National, where nothing's off limits.
You know, part of being an adult is dealing with discomfort.
We gather the sharpest minds around to hash over what's shaping this crazy world.
Both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party succumbed to big money.
Late Night Live, 4 new shows a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mark Zuckerberg is building a photorealistic AI clone of himself to center meetings mostly. It's trained on his voice, his face, his mannerisms, and his strategic thinking, which, yes, does raise the question of how anyone will tell the difference, but would you make one of you? And if you did, what would it mean for your data and your identity? My name is Rae Johnston, and welcome to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Now joining me to unpack some of the biggest stories in tech right now is Georgia Dixon, Managing Editor at Whistle Out Singapore. Welcome back, Georgia.
Thank you for having me.
And Chris Berg, Professor of Economics at RMIT. Welcome back, Chris.
Wonderful to join.
Now, Tim Cook, or Tim Apple, as he is often known, is stepping down as Apple's CEO after 15 years at the helm. Not a bad run. He's handing the reins over to John Ternus, who is Apple's head of hardware engineering. So, considering Apple has only had 3 CEOs ever, this being the third one, Georgia, how big a deal is this handover?
Look, it is a pretty big deal. Since 1997, it's been about the same turnover rate as the Pope. So, but really,
that's the biggest measurement system.
The reason why it is such a big deal is that Tim Cook was incredibly successful as CEO. He grew the company's value by more than $3.6 trillion. So, new CEO John Ternus has very, very big shoes to fill. And on top of that, Ternus has a strong history in the company working on product as more of a hardware guy, while Cook was always more of a spreadsheets guy. So the shift will be very interesting to see play out.
Yeah, Chris, John Ternus being a hardware engineer is something that we've read a lot over the last few days. But what do we know about him otherwise? I found it pretty interesting going to his LinkedIn that it is incredibly bare, which is kind of refreshing for someone of this status.
Well, clearly he's not on the job market. So, look, John Ternus is a really interesting choice. He's obviously an internal pick from Apple. Apple went through a long history of external CEOs that sometimes was successful, but more famously was not successful. And in Tim Cook and now John Ternus, they've obviously decided to keep it in house. The fact that he's a hardware guy is very significant, I think, particularly as Apple positions itself in the AI era. We may be even though AI is software only, and it's a thing that runs on servers and data centers, it does look like we're entering a fairly radical moment of revisiting the form of computing itself. For the last decade, 2 decades, we've had computers and we've had phones. And Apple has obviously wanted to push the boundaries there by looking at the Vision Pro, the big VR headset. Meta has its augmented reality glasses. OpenAI is talking about having a physical AI device. In fact, a physical AI device designed by one of the former Apple designers, Jony Ive as well. So in that sense, we could be moving towards a quite new era in the form of computing, which wouldn't be a surprise given the changes in computing that the AI revolution has driven. It's possible that by choosing John Ternus, Apple is trying to get ahead of that curve.
I think it is really interesting for Apple's direction going forward, especially when we look back and see Tim Cook's legacy, you could say, is that he quadrupled Apple's revenue, mostly through subscriptions and software. So, Georgia, is that something that we're likely to see continue? Is John going to come in and go, no, we're just hardware now? Forget about this revenue raising.
Yeah, I don't think that's ever going to happen. I think those subscriptions and software will still play a very big part. But it does feel kind of indicative of Apple potentially pivoting a bit more towards having that hardware focus. Like, Apple knows that it's in-house silicon, which the transition to which from Intel was actually led by Turnus, is one of its biggest strengths and biggest points of difference from its competitors.
So we're looking at John. I'm looking at his past record here. The Apple Vision Pro is something that he was responsible for. So, Chris, do you think that we're going to see more creativity in the gadgets that Apple releases in the future? Are we going to get back to fun Apple again?
I find all parts of Apple fun.
yes, but you're an academic, Chris.
yeah, exactly. I find anything fun. So I expect so. So the Vision Pro has been a really compelling product. I don't have a Vision Pro myself, but it's been a very compelling product by all accounts. But it hasn't really broken through to that mass market that obviously the iPhone did, or even the iPod before it. So there's a bunch of directions that they should go. I'm actually more excited about not virtual reality platforms, but the parts of the Apple Vision Pro and other products that are the augmented reality. I think there's a strong likelihood that the more useful form factor for computing, at least sort of eyeball-based computing, in the future is glasses or vision headsets that you can see through and that add information to you. And now the Apple Vision Pro does a bit of that, but to get it to work really well, you've got to radically reduce the weight and you've got to somehow move all the computation. Either you've got to shrink it really aggressively or you've got to move it off the device. Now, that seems to me to be an interesting direction. The other direction, though, that computing is going, which again is a hardware thing, is voice. So more and more software developers are interacting with their AI systems through voice only. Fewer and fewer people are typing, more and more people are speaking to their computers in the AI era, in the LLM era. And I know that's the direction that OpenAI is looking to go with its devices. My big open question is, will that be the direction that Apple chooses to go as well? Will we be communicating with our Apple products or really any products through voice and eyeballs more than we do typing and pressing buttons as we do at the moment?
Chris, that's the first time I've ever heard anyone use the term eyeball-based computing. And I thank you for bringing it into my life.
Well, I've copyrighted it, so.
Fantastic. You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you, and I'm joined by Chris Berg, who is a professor of economics at RMIT, and also Georgia Dixon, who is the managing editor at Whistle Out Singapore. And Meta has installed new tracking software on employees' computers that captures mouse movements and clicks and keystrokes, screenshots, all in the name of training its AI tools. And the tool is called the Model Capability Initiative, apparently part of Meta's push to build AI agents that can do computer-based tasks autonomously. Meta says the data will not be used for performance reviews, which we will apparently believe. Exactly what is Meta capturing from its employees, Georgia?
So as you mentioned, this new tool that they're installing on all its US employees' computers captures mouse activity, clicks, keystrokes, and takes occasional screenshots of the actual content on their employees' screens. And basically the reason they're doing this is because there are gaps in what Meta's AI agents are currently capable of doing. You know, they can't use drop-down menus or click buttons and use keyboard shortcuts. It's the same reason why you have to tick a box on some websites asking you to prove that you're not a robot.
Right. Okay. So, Chris, what is Meta actually building with this information? What is the Model Capability Initiative?
Well, I mean, you can easily see what a model that is trained on this sort of data could do. Think about the way AI models have worked, you know, thus far for the last couple of years, is that they are trained on internet text and they are trained to predict the next token. And it turns out that they get the next word in a sentence, I should say, using a token system. And you get a whole lot of capabilities from that. You can even get a degree of capability around the AI figuring out how computers work, because they can look at a screenshot of a window and they can figure out, well, that's where the button is and so forth. But what Meta is trying to do, and they're not the only people trying to do this, what Meta is trying to do is train specific AI models on the way we all interact with our computers. So where do we move our mouse when we are browsing a website? Where do our eyes go when we are looking at a screen? That these are really useful pieces of information that you could train an AI model on so that the AI could autonomously operate the computer. So a lot of people have tried to run these, what we call computer use models, where the AI can actually run the computer itself, but without getting that direct information about how people actually use computers, it's very difficult to sort of reverse engineer it. And that's what they're doing. And from Meta's perspective, I can see the reasoning, which is that they've got all these employees. They've got all these employees using their computers all day. That is, frankly, a massive data set that you could collect, then train an AI engine on, and then suddenly through almost for free, you've got a really substantial AI model that can do computer use. Now, how does that connect to how a lot of us feel about surveillance in the workplace, how a lot of us feel about the coming challenge that AI brings to employment and so forth? That's where it gets difficult, but you can see the advantages. And we do want these models. We actually do want computer use models. And we're going to have to collect this data somehow. Meta is coming up with a system to do so.
I think that it's really difficult for people to hear about this and not be reminded of all of the software that was implemented when work from home mandates were in place during COVID lockdowns. And we were being made sure that our eyes were looking at the screen and that our mouse was moving at all times. And Meta says that they've put safeguards in place to make sure that this software will not affect performance reviews of the employees who are having their every second on their computer tracked. Do we trust this, Georgia?
Look, it is really, really hard to believe that statement when Meta is reportedly planning to cut about 10% of its global workforce in about a month's time, which is about 8,000 people potentially losing their jobs. And that's just the first round of layoffs. You know, some insiders are suggesting there could be more redundancies in the second half of the year. But, you know, if they have all this data about their employees at their fingertips, and the only thing separating two workers from staying or getting the boot was how much or how little their work had contributed to the AI, I can't imagine that wouldn't affect Meta's decision.
You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you, and I'm joined by Georgia Dixon, who is the Managing Editor at Whistle Out Singapore, and Chris Berg, Professor of Economics at RMIT. Now, I want you to imagine an AI model built on everything you know, how you communicate, how you reason, how you write, trained to act and respond like you so well that you can send it to meetings on your behalf. Would you? We're talking about the idea of digital twins, and they're more than an idea. They're becoming very much a reality. Georgia, take me back, though. How did the idea of a digital twin first come about?
Yeah, it sounds something, you know, super modern, but it actually came about at NASA over 50 years ago when they first used simulators to assess why the Apollo 13's oxygen tanks failed. That technology continued to evolve, and now NASA is still using digital twins, but now they're powered by AI, on projects like the Perseverance Mars rover and the James Webb Space Telescope to make predictions, run diagnostics, and make real-time recommendations.
I love this. So how do we get from space-driven simulations to AI replicas of office workers, which is what we're talking about now, Chris?
Well, so I find this a little bit difficult because if you ask people what a digital twin is, it can be almost anything. We've been talking about digital twins in supply chain management, digital twins of shipping objects and that sort of thing for a very long time. What's interesting here, though, is the idea that you can create off your own data a version of you that might, an AI robot effectively that might respond in the way that you would respond. Now, I find this super interesting because I'm trying to do exactly that at the moment. I've gotten it working off all the things I've written in the past, all my thoughts, all my research records, all my ideas that I've been writing down over like the space of decades. And I'm trying to get the robot to get an AI model, Claude or ChatGPT, to navigate all that because it's going to make my life easier. It's going to it helps me do my research and it helps me think through ideas and all that sort of thing. Now, is that a digital Chris? I'm not convinced. I haven't managed to get it to go to meetings for me yet. That is absolutely the dream. I think a lot of people are experimenting with ways to try to get not digital twins of themselves, but to use all the content and all their all the stuff that they've done, particularly in their professional life, to do their job more efficiently, or to be able to do more of their job faster, or more effectively, or more compellingly. Because again, we've been collecting data. You know, we complain about how the internet big tech giants are collecting data about us. We've also been collecting data about ourselves for a very long time. It's there. It's available for the AI systems if we choose to let it to use. I mean, why not take advantage of that? So this is what I've been experimenting with over the last couple of months, and it works actually really, really well. I just need to get it to go to meetings for me now.
That's incredible, Chris. I do need to pick your brain for a second. You know, how do you balance security and safety with feeding an AI model all this information about yourself? What are the questions that you ask? What are the challenges you have?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I have done things like give AI models access to my email accounts in the past. I don't think they have that at the moment. And the way I think about it, and this may not be sensible, and please don't take this as advice, but the way I think about it is that I've already given access to all my personal information to, I've got a Gmail account. I've given it to the Gmail division of the Google company. So giving it to the Gemini division of the Google company doesn't strike me as a massive change. Now, I know through the terms of service that they're not training models on the basis of my data, but at the same time, you know, and you might doubt that, but at the same time, do I know that about Gmail, my email account as well? So in a funny way, we've already given up so much and we've already handed off stuff. I'm not keeping my emails on a private server in my home. I'm keeping it already on the internet, on high quality data centers and high quality cybersecurity of a degree that I would never be able to do. So I think sometimes that claim is overstated. We may talk next week and we may discover that, I've been hacked and it's incredibly embarrassing. But for now, that's how I think about it.
It's so funny that you mentioned this. As we're speaking, I receive an email from Google talking about workspace intelligence and an update that's being made to it. And part of this email is saying that workspace intelligence securely draws from content in Gmail, Drive, Chat, and Calendar, as well as connected third-party sources to deliver personalized outputs via Gemini 3 reasoning. So I believe that having access, based on that statement, to your emails is something that Google's already going to have. So yeah, it kind of makes the decision as to whether or not we make digital twins of ourselves to do the jobs that we don't want to do a little bit easier, right?
And I think it speaks to an important thing that we all need to be aware of, that it is right now there's a massive hype cycle, probably correctly, about AI. And it's all, and people are talking about all the challenges and risks and so forth. But we need to make sure that we understand those risks and challenges, which is very real, relative to the risks that we've already chosen to very willingly adopt around the rest of our digital lives as well. Now, you may say that the AI stuff goes too far, and I would understand that. But at the same time, I think there's been such a aggressive backlash to so many AI platforms on the basis, on grounds that we would never accept if it was applied to the rest of our digital lives. All we need to do is think very carefully about the choices that we are making and the choices that we have already made and act accordingly.
Georgia, I'm curious as to what happens to our digital twins. Say we leave a job or retire or pass away, you know, does it stay with the employer? Could they just keep us on the books?
I mean, yeah, this is the big question with this whole digital twin thing, is who actually owns your digital twin? You know, one company in the UK has actually rolled this out to its entire workforce, and they believe that individuals should own their digital twins and that they should benefit from any value generated by their twin. But other companies are implementing similar tools. They believe that whatever the worker produces, including their digital twin and whatever their digital twin produces, belongs to them entirely. And they argue that, you know, the digital twin of someone who leaves the company will eventually fall behind the point that they're no longer usable. So there'll have to be a lot of laws developed around this. But yeah, in terms of what happens to your digital twin when you retire or die, that UK company I mentioned, they say that having a digital twin has allowed someone who was going to retire to start transitioning to retirement a bit earlier. They had someone go on maternity leave and she's just been replaced by her digital twin. So it really will depend on what laws come about, but also the company. You know, I'm assuming there'll be something in contracts in the future where you have to sign away your rights to your digital twin, or if you get to keep it. But yeah, if the company owns it, they may be able to use your twin in perpetuity. So they could be benefiting from your work without paying you for it for years to come.
Now, Chris, I know how you stand on this, considering you are currently in the process of creating one, but Georgia, would you create a digital twin of yourself?
Oh, look, not now. It feels a bit severancey for my liking. Like, I would worry that digital Georgia would eventually come me in the inevitable robot uprising. But more of the problem that I have is that we know that generative AI can and does make mistakes. And I would worry that if digital Georgia made a mistake, since she's just a me-flavored chatbot, you know, am I going to get disciplined for that? Like, is it my fault if my AI self makes a mistake? And yeah, just like, where is the accountability for that kind of thing?
Now, thank you both so much for joining us on Download This Show. I know that tech news can sometimes be a little bit bleak, so I do love to bring some joy to the program as well. And Chris, I'd love for you to tell me about some tech that has brought you joy this week.
Absolutely. So not just this week, today. So there's a cool little program. I'll just tell you about it and why it's interesting, called flipbook.page. And if you Google it, that's what it comes up with. And what it is it's a vision of the future of the internet as a internet that constantly generates itself. So imagine, instead of visiting a web page, you are visiting a constantly regenerating, rebuilding, restructuring vision of the information and text that you are interested in seeing. This has been an interesting possibility for a while, the idea that because of generative AI, we could make custom web pages customized specifically to the individuals that visit them based on their own preferences, rather than just what the corporate website provider wants us to look at. And this is it's just a minimum viable product. So it's just a demonstration of what that could look like, a amorphous, constantly recomposing, highly visual, very entertaining vision of what the web may well turn out to be in coming years.
That's fascinating, Chris. I never would have heard of this without you. Thank you. And Georgia, tell me about some tech that brought you joy this week.
My current obsession is a Nintendo Switch game called Tomodachi Life, Living the Dream.
Excellent.
It's kind of like if The Sims and Animal Crossing had a really weird baby. You can have like 70 residents on your island and you can make those residents whoever or whatever you want. I've seen people on TikTok making Furbies, celebrities, their pets. And it's also important to note that this game has zero filter or censorship. So you can make them say literally anything, which has led to some very funny results.
Excellent.
But yeah, my island is currently just a dumping ground of characters from my favorite TV shows. I've got Mulder and Scully there. I've got the boys from Heated Rivalry, Louis and Lestat from Interview with the Vampire. It's absolutely unhinged, but in the best possible way. And it's a really nice little escape from the atrocities of the real world, much like Animal Crossing was back in 2020.
I love it. Georgia Dixon, Managing Editor at Whistle Out Singapore, thank you so much for joining us on Download This Show. Where can people find your work?
Thank you for having me. They can find me at whistleout.com.sg, also .com.au. I occasionally pop over to the Australian site.
Perfect. And Chris Berg, Professor of Economics at RMIT, where can people find you and your work?
I'm easy to find on google.com.
That is the best find me we've had on the program. I appreciate you both. Thank you both so much.
Thank
Not
you.
Not at all. Thank you.
And some more tech news from the week that was. In case you missed it, the Australian Automobile Association has tested 17 vehicles on real roads and found most fail to deliver the fuel economy or driving range that their manufacturers advertise. The worst offender was the GWM Jolyon Hybrid, which burned 27% more fuel than its lab result. And neither BYD electric vehicles came close to their promised range. The AAA says buyers should be deeply sceptical of the figures on the sticker. Google kicked off its annual Cloud Next conference in Las Vegas this week with a wave of announcements built around AI agents, software that is claimed to autonomously handle tasks on a computer without a human doing each step. The centerpiece is the Gemini Enterprise Agent platform, backed by a $750 million fund to help businesses deploy it, and Google's eighth generation custom AI chips. CEO Sundar Pichai also revealed that around 75% of all new Google code is now written by AI. And Australia's first solar panel recycling research centre has been launched at the University of New South Wales, Sydney, bringing together engineers and scientists and policymakers to address the country's growing solar waste crisis. With more than 4.3 million solar systems installed nationwide, government figures predict annual panel waste will surge from around 59,000 tonnes this year to over 91,000 tonnes by 2030, with currently only a small number of systems recycled when decommissioned. The new hub will examine recycling processes, material recovery, policy standards, and panel redesign. And that's all for this week on Download This Show. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any of our future episodes. And yes, we do love hearing your thoughts and your feedback. You can send them over to downloadthisshow@abc.net.au. That's on email. Or you can send me a DM on Instagram. You can find me there at Ray Johnston. Just this week, I received an email, thank you, Craig, who suggested we tweak the theme song. So tell me, what do you think? Are you attached to the Download tune as it stands, or would you like to hear a refresh? At Ray Johnston on Instagram is where you can let me know, or email downloadthisshow@abc.net.au. I'm Ray Johnston, and you have been listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.